In this week's episode, Emma Pottinger is joined by Nathan Waller from the Family Building Society. They're going to discuss the current market situation in respect of mortgages.
Accountancy on Prescription by RBP, one of the leading firms of medical specialist accountants. We know what you find tough, but don't you worry, as we know our stuff.
Welcome to this week's episode of Accountancy on Prescription. I'm Emma Pottinger, and this week we have a new guest who would like to share their insight on the current market situation in respect to mortgages. Hello, Nathan.
Hi, Emma. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Nathan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, certainly. My name's Nathan Waller. I'm what's called a business development manager, aka BDM, for a mortgage lender called Family Building Society.
Well, thank you. So up to now, we haven't actually had a specific building society join our show. So thank you for joining us. So tell me, what does your role involve?
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. So effectively, the best way to explain my role is a key conduit between your mortgage advisor and the lender that I represent. Our role is effectively to provide assistance, guidance, support and updates to your mortgage advisor in order for them to be able to provide the customer with the best possible advice as to where your mortgage should be placed.
So why do actual mortgage lenders need a BDM?
So effectively, every mortgage lender has different criterias, different kind of risk appetites in who they are looking to lend to. As I'm sure you can appreciate, there's a wide variety of customers out there with a wide variety of different circumstances. And although each mortgage lender wants to help as many people as they possibly can, it's simply not feasible for all of us to try and compete for the same customer, much in the same way that any service-based business really tries to carve its own niche out to provide products or services to a certain type of customer.
So a bit like ourselves, as you know, we specialise within the medical sector. So who's your target market?
So for us, our target market, although we will happily consider the needs of the majority, such as the high street lenders that I'm sure your listeners will recognise and know, such as like your Nationwides, Halifax's, NatWest, things like that, we tend to focus more on the areas that those lenders don't necessarily have as much of an appetite for, such as older borrowers, those who may want or need a standard mortgage later in life, all the way to the age of 95. Expatriates, for example, those who may have retired abroad, moved abroad, looking at either keeping a property over here for them to pop to and from when they want to come and see family, or for buy-to-lets, for things like that, and want to keep a property within England and Wales.
Okay, so like most of our listeners will have a mortgage or have had a mortgage in the past. Are there any innovations in the market other than just like the standard mortgage?
Yes, so there's a wide variety of mortgage schemes out there. And as you allude to, most of your listeners, I'm sure, will be completely aware of your typical standard mortgage, which is two applicants or two people or up to named on the mortgage, going onto the title of the property, both their incomes and credit commitments and things taken into consideration. And obviously a maximum loan is calculated based on what the lender feels is affordable for them on that information. But as we're seeing with the cost of living, rising property prices, not necessarily keeping in line with incomes in a lot of areas, also increases in stamp duties, as well as customers living longer, we as lenders have really had to kind of innovate and adapt and try and help each of these different customers achieve their dreams of home ownership, but also sometimes for them to continue in their own home as well. So there are a multitude of different products, not just, as we've alluded to, the standard ones, but there are some products and lenders that will lend up to maybe 6 times income. It's quite a high loan amount for a lot of people, but that's really where there are people that are aspiring to maybe go up the ladder in regards to their professional career. So actually looking at their current income isn't truly indicative of where they will be in a year or 2 years' time. There's 100% mortgages out there with family assistance, where they might be putting down security in either savings or secured charges against their home, rather than necessarily providing them with a gifted deposit. Joint borrower sole proprietor. Now, that's quite a new term, and that's something that is really becoming quite popular within the market. And interest-only mortgages. A lot of lenders don't look at those anymore, whereas there are a few that do. Other options you can look at when you're kind of looking at the overall picture of the customer, the client might have pension funds in retirement. So there are even some lenders that consider using stocks, shares, investments, money that's been squirreled away for a rainy day, as well as the standard employment and self-employed income.
Nathan, you just mentioned a joint borrower's sole proprietor mortgage. I mean, that sounds quite confusing. What does it actually mean?
So it's kind of born out of the changes in stamp duty for second home ownership. And most people might relate this to kind of older style mortgages, such as guarantor mortgages, as an example. So taking it back to basics, on a typical mortgage contract, all the customers are named on the mortgage and are both liable for that debt.
Yeah.
But on top of that, they are also named on the title deeds, which in most cases is what the customer or what the listener would want to have. However, in some scenarios, this might not be of the utmost importance. Generally, where this is used is where family members, such as parents, are happy to help with the affordability in order to meet the mortgage payments and are happy to be liable for the mortgage debt, but aren't necessarily so interested in being on the mortgage title, as they only are really looking to provide a helping hand. So in this example, the parents potentially could jump on, help with the affordability. They're not going on to the mortgage title, and therefore this could potentially save money on stamp duty, as it would fall under the scope of a second home in a standard mortgage contract. And obviously we've just seen that that's recently been increased further in the most recent budget.
That's right. I mean, what impact do you think the budget will have on the housing market?
Well, it's very tricky to predict. There are a lot of moving factors, not just the budget, but also a lot of things out there in the world today. There's been a huge amount of volatility in swap rates following that budget, which listeners may have seen led to mortgage rates increasing at the end of last year. From us as a mortgage lender and from looking further forward, the general consensus does seem to be that things will settle down again and will be a little bit more consistent. The increase in the stamp duty, as I previously mentioned, for second homeowners in the long term probably isn't likely to put off those that may have multiple properties, such as the seasoned property portfolio landlords, as an example. They'll just factor that into their overall costs. On a property of value of 100,000, for example, it's only an extra $2,000. And if that 2,000 is enough to make that buy-to-let property kind of unviable, then it probably wasn't the correct investment in the first place. So I don't think it's necessarily going to put them off too much. But again, this is where the joint borrower sole proprietor product mentioned before will be a benefit to those family members, as it won't really impact them at all. So I think we'll see more of those types of things just continue, especially if cost of living continue to increase, where it may not necessarily be affordable just on one or two customers' income.
Understand. I mean, I suppose the bigger impact is for the first-time buyers.
Yes, so they will lose their increased threshold for stamp duty that is coming into play this year.
So what's your feeling for this year?
The overall feel from the majority of lenders, from what we've seen, and also from us at Family, is that 2025 should still be a very positive year.
Well, that's good to hear. Would you say there's any other factors from the budget that might impact lending?
One area that could impact lending, changes to pensions, how they factor in to IHT moving forward. I would recommend anyone with pension funds to talk to their advisor about the impact that this may have, because there is a range of lending options that potentially can feed into that as well.
Can you give any examples of this?
Yes, certainly. So I get regular calls or inquiries from brokers looking for stuff for their customers, such as interest-only residential mortgages. As I mentioned to you earlier in this podcast, it's not everyone knows they are still around. The high street aren't necessarily looking at those types of mortgage, whereas lenders like us will. Also, equity release is another. That's gone through a lot of changes, and a lot of the stigma and the problems that were around equity release are beginning to become a lot better now. And lenders such as ourselves can look at monetizing pension funds to enhance affordability, as using a pot of money that the client can utilise to draw upon on a regular basis to meet their monthly payments.
You mentioned earlier, and I've also seen that it's been widely publicised, that one of the biggest lenders in the UK is like the bank of mum and dad. Have you seen this?
It's huge. It's one of the terms that you do see quite a lot. And also it's expanding a little bit more to the bank of nan and granddad as well. It really is.
I do hope not.
Well, if you look at the information that's available, people are living longer.
Yeah.
And it's an inspirational thing for home ownership for a lot of families. And sometimes nans, granddads are actually beginning to see their grandkids live longer and want to see them in the house and let them enjoy their assets rather than waiting until inheritance. So you tend to see that this is a really big area, and normally the bank of mum and dad aren't giving them money themselves, such as us as a mortgage lender. They're not providing them with the full mortgage and doing a loan commitment and a loan agreement between them. It's in the form of gifted deposits and can be sometimes funded from lump sum drawdown from pension funds. It could also be in investments, stocks, shares. But also the wider implication is this potentially could be liable to a large income tax bill, which, subject to status of the customer and subject to their own individual kind of circumstances, will vary. And we do certainly see customers taking advantage of what I've potentially already mentioned to mitigate this. As I said, it's always best to talk to the advisor before doing anything like this and making sure that it's the right advice, because everybody's circumstances is different. So quality advice here is key.
Absolutely. Can I ask you something? We've seen the base rate fall, yet mortgage rates aren't falling as quickly. Why is that?
So there are a couple of factors to consider here. It depends on the individual mortgage lender, as we've mentioned earlier, their appetite to risk and what customers they're looking to, and primarily how they are funded. A lender generally isn't giving you their own money to buy the property or to remortgage the property and to switch it from one lender to another. They are effectively borrowing that money from a source to lend out to you. And obviously the money that they're getting will come at a cost. And that's not necessarily directly linked to the base rate.
What do you mean borrowing from other sources?
So I'll take us as an example. We are primarily funded from customers depositing their money in savings accounts, such as ISAs, bonds, easy access savers, fixed rate saving accounts, and things like that. And for that money that customer has ever so kindly given to us for 1, 2, 3 years, or as an easy access facility, we give them interest on that money to say thank you. So before we do anything else, we need to ensure that we've entered into a contract with that customer, similar to a mortgage contract, where that customer agrees to pay us a certain amount of money on a monthly basis. We agree to that customer to give them a rate of interest, whether it be annually, whether it be monthly, whatever the product might be. So first of all, we've got to make sure that we can cover that promise to that customer there. And then, as with any other business, there are running costs in order for us to keep our doors open so that we can ensure that we can pay them that money on a monthly or annual basis. We need to keep the computers running. We need to pay the staff that look after the day-to-day operations. And we obviously need to keep money in the background just to make sure that we are able to protect those monies for an individual person.
I mean, that's interesting. I mean, so surely you need to ensure you've got enough capital in your bank account in case anything went wrong.
Yes, very much so. Prime example of what happens when you don't have enough capital in the bank was the collapse of that very well-known bank in 2017. Everyone was queuing up outside the front door, taking all their money out in a very quick period of time, which meant that it was carnage. And that meant that that lender didn't have the capital in their own bank accounts to stay open. But what it also meant is, because they didn't have that capital in the background to protect themselves against a run, is no one else was going to give them any additional money that they could then get themselves out of that situation in the first place. So it ended up being in a bit of a tricky cycle. Also, quite a lot of savings accounts also have a fixed rate of interest. So despite the base rate dropping, our cost of the funding remains exactly the same, no matter what the base rate does. So we are still committed to pay the same amount of money to that customer from day one to day 364, irrelevant of when the base rate may or may not have changed. So that doesn't really impact things either, because that's the main thing, that this really dictates the profit margin that we need to make in order to continue the lending. The amount of money we need to pay out compared to the amount of money it costs us to run dictates really what we can charge on the mortgage product. So it doesn't work quite in the same way. And we also, like most mortgage lenders, utilize swaps in order to fund our fixed rate mortgages as well.
What do you mean by swap?
So a swap effectively is, if you think of it as a contractual agreement between two parties, is how it's really defined. It's basically borrowing money from one place to another, in which point you agree to swap a set of interest payments over another for a specific time frame, such as 1, 2, 3, 5, up to 10 years. And this effectively locks in that monthly payment and margin directly to the product type. So we do a 5-year fixed mortgage, that will be directly linked to a 5-year swap rate, because that's what we're swapping the interest on. And that isn't directly linked to the base rate. That's directly linked to more market conditions and predictions in regards to where rates will be in the future. So that's probably the biggest factor when it comes to kind of pricing fixed rate mortgages, is although the base rates might be changing, the swap rates are really the underlying rates that may impact our pricing decisions.
You mentioned about monetizing pensions and investments earlier. What's the benefit in that?
There's a few different benefits, really. The majority of high street mortgage lenders will look to lend on income that they can show is currently being received or is kind of guaranteed to be received either now or in retirement, such as salaries, dividends, overtimes and things like that, annuity-based or final salary-based pension schemes. So something that that lender can hang their hat on and say that it is relatively guaranteed for the term of that mortgage, because, well, there's a employment contract in place or there's a pension contract in place. So there are alternatives out there, as I've alluded to, and we're one of the few lenders that will actually look at a customer's pension fund, for example, to help cover affordability, potentially now or in retirement, so as long as they can access it. So at the moment, over 55 plus, which will be changing in a few years' time. But as an example, customer could have made extremely good use of their maximum pension contribution each year for them to be as tax efficient as possible at this moment, but also really to provide themselves a good quality of life and a good income later in life.
Yeah.
But the beauty of monetizing the pensions and investments and the flexible drawdown facilities such as SIPs, SASSes, even stocks and shares pensions and stocks and shares ISAs and things like that, is you can, as long as you're eligible to, take as much or as little out of that at any time if you wish. And generally speaking, those customers that have thought about the long-term implications and have secured themselves a comfortable future aren't typically the kind of customer that will just retire, go out tomorrow and spend it all on something absolutely crazy. Yeah. They are generally the type of customer that are sensible, so we treat them that way. And what we would effectively look to do is take 90% of that fund as it stands today, because we, as a lender, need to be mindful of increases or decreases in the value of that fund just from the natural way the market might be at the time. And then we look to divide that available amount of money over the potential mortgage term that they are looking to utilize it for.
Okay. I mean, to give our listeners a better understanding of that, sorry to put you on the spot, but can you give an example of this?
Yep, certainly. So I like to use easy figures as much as I possibly can, because then it's nice and simple and clear. So I'm going to take, let's say, £500,000 pension fund as a guide. And say, mainly because the figures are easy to work out rather than looking at individual weird numbers. So let's take £500,000. 90% of that would turn into a nice and simple £450,000 worth of usable money that we can look to do. Say the listener or customer wants to take a 10-year mortgage with that. Mm-hmm. Divide it by 10. That's a £45,000 potential income that we can utilise. Say they wanted a mortgage over a longer period of time, then fine. Divide it by 20 as a guide, that's £22,500. It's as simple as that. We get a lot of inquiries from customers who are looking to do just this for a multitude of different reasons. Now, they might be looking at topping up their current earned income to support the borrowing, because actually they may have taken a bit of a back step from what they were doing before, maybe only doing 1 or 2 days instead of the 5 days that they were doing before that, and can utilize their pensions to then jump up and kind of protect any shortfall. But it could be that they may not want to pay their mortgage down. They might have a previous interest-only mortgage at this moment in time. Their lender is saying, you can't do anything with it. You've got to pay us our money back. So they think, oh, I'll just cash me pension. It might have a significant amount of implications on tax, and they would rather maybe keep that mortgage for another 5 or 10 years and then gradually pay it off over that period of time.
Okay.
We've alluded to the bank of mum and dad, the bank of nan and granddad as well. Could be a gift to family. They may not want to help with things like joint borrower, sole proprietor, and go on and assist with the mortgage lending, but they might say, well, actually, here's an extra 50, 60, 70,000 pounds that you can then put towards that property. It might be doing significant improvements to their own home, putting in new kitchens, new bathrooms, maybe putting an extension on it or something like that. Or they just haven't done anything for a while and now they've kind of realised that, oh, we really should get around to doing this, and and they've now got the time to do it. Yeah. So there's those types of things that they could look to utilise it rather than drawing on it in a big lump sum. They could utilise borrowing to spread it over a few years. And again, subject to status, a subject to their own personal circumstances and talking to the right person could potentially save them a significant amount of money.
Okay, that's good to know. I mean, something that our listeners may be interested in is like buy-to-lets. I mean, we're seeing some clients considering purchasing new buy-to-lets in a limited company. Are you seeing that?
Yes, definitely. I would even go to the lengths to say it is now the majority of the market for new property purchases within this sector. And we are now beginning to see a lot of people with existing portfolios beginning to transfer that into a company structure.
Why is that?
Primarily for tax reasons. So there's been a few changes in how properties in personal names can be treated. So if, for example, a standard buy-to-let property, so a normal house or flat rented to a standard tenant, so it's not a holiday let or HMO or anything quirky like that, is owned in a person's personal name, whereas before you could offset the mortgage costs as a entire business expense to lower your net income and therefore potentially lower your taxable income that's due for that year. You can't do that in the same way anymore, but that can be done if it is done through a limited company buy to let. So for the occasional landlord that has a moderate level of kind of personal income and maybe one buy to let, it may not make a huge amount of difference, as now you are entitled to a tax credit that kind of offsets the majority of the tax implications for that. But once you do go above the basic rate and start getting into your higher rate tax brackets and things like that, things do start getting a bit more interesting, let's say. And that's really where good quality advice does pay dividends as to whether it's better or not to hold a property within a company structure. Also in the past, where the majority of properties may have been held in personal names, the vast majority of mortgage lenders out there were providing the products to those customers, and the competition for those products meant that generally those that wanted to hold a buy-to-let within a limited company, the products were pretty scarce, and there was only really a handful of lenders that operated within that kind of space. So, of course, it's a market that hasn't got the demand. So the rates might have been slightly higher. It was deemed as a riskier way for the mortgage lender to enter into those types of contracts. So rates were significantly higher and maybe fees were higher than that. Whereas now, because of the change in the market, more lenders are in that space. It is now common for pretty much all buy-to-let mortgage lenders out there now to offer buy-to-let limited company products. So now we are seeing that rates are a lot closer together compared to old personal name products. And even with some lenders, pricing exactly the same, whether it be held in a personal or a limited company structure. So again, we're seeing the appetite changing for taxation being better for people, as well as now the rates aren't so different anymore. So actually, it doesn't really cost them that much less on the mortgage payment either. The other thing to mention is your listeners do need to consider the potential tax implications of moving existing buy-to-lets into a company structure, as there's likeliness to incur capital gains tax, which would become payable within 60 days of transfer. Also, if there is a mortgage on there, and there could potentially be stamp duty tax liabilities as well. So it is key to look at good quality advice for changing that.
I know we tend to see clients doing this for new purchases. I'd suggest if any of our listeners are thinking about this, it's really important to get advice, as once the property's in a company, it could be difficult and also costly to get it out the company. So are you seeing any changes within the buy-to-let market?
Yes, we are seeing a lot of changes within that sector. So as I mentioned, it's not necessarily just in the way that properties are owned, i.e. the change in personal name to limited company in that kind of pattern. We're seeing, because with a limited company, you can have other directors and shareholders rather than just two or three applicants or something on the mortgage. We're seeing the addition of family members onto the company to help with their long-term financial goals for inheritance planning, for example, by adding them on as mentioned, directors or shareholders within the company. We're also seeing a significant diversification for landlords in their portfolio, which incorporates different property types. So we've talked about a very basic standard buy-to-let, which most people would kind of know and recognize as a house or flat let to a family or a couple, for example. But we're seeing a lot of seasoned landlords moving into HMOs, multi-unit freehold properties, holiday lets, for example, as well, and even student accommodation. And they're looking at adding that to their portfolio as well as the standard houses or flats. We also, as a lender, have an offset buy-to-let product that we have had a lot of success with, where clients that may still keep properties within the personal names would like to utilize a flexible facility to maybe reduce their mortgage payments and or use the money instead of short-term finance like bridging, where they may need to do works to properties within their portfolio.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned about landlords are looking at HMOs or multi-unit freehold properties. What are they and why are they being looked at more now?
So as with any business owner, because let's be honest, the portfolio of properties effectively is a business and it's being run that way, a landlord would be looking at ways to maximize their return on their investment by getting a good yield. Generally speaking, higher yields usually will come at what's deemed as a higher risk. So there's always a balancing act, I suppose, to play in regards to the risk appetite of the customer and the return that they would get from that property.
What do you mean by that?
Well, as an example, let's start with a multi-unit freehold block. So typically, this would be a converted house that's been split into two or more flats, as an example, which is quite commonplace within the UK. And I'm sure people will notice down some streets and things, you'd have maybe 31 and 31A types of addresses where it was 31 that was a standard house and now there's a downstairs flat and an upstairs flat. It may have been previously a three-bed house that I'm just going to use some rough figures as an example here, just to kind of illustrate the point rather than picking specific examples out here. But okay, that potentially could maybe have rented to a family for maybe £1,000 a month, let's say. Instead, now that property has been converted into two-bed flats. And let's say they can maybe get £700 a month for rental for that. Straight away, you can see that there's an additional £400 a month. So that gives, for the same property to some extent, a higher return. But there is an inherent risk that there's no guarantee that at any given time both flats are always going to be tenanted. There's potentially two sets of issues that might arise in regards to works that need to be done to it, and there'll be likely costs involved for finding a new tenant, for example. A flat is likely to be rented by a couple who may look to upsize in the future, whereas a three-bed house might already be the family that's got a child that wants the garden and they're not looking to move for a while because the children go to school in the area. So you're kind of balancing the risk of the tenant and the property and making sure that it's all there the whole time. And potentially it's two sets of letting agent fees for finding new tenants and things like that. So yes, there is the potential for a higher return, but there's the potential for the higher risk. And again, it's balancing those out.
What about HMO?
So the simplest way to explain a HMO or a house of multiple occupancy, which is the longer explanation of it, effectively, it's like a house share. Each tenancy will be for an individual room, bedroom within that property. It might have an ensuite, for example, and the use of communal areas such as kitchens and lounges. So you could have a four-bed property that might have rented to a family for maybe £1,300 a month, but you could also have those four bedrooms that are upstairs as individual lets. And you might have had a lounge, a dining room, and kitchen and bits and pieces, and you might convert maybe that dining room into another bedroom, which would give you five bedrooms in that as an individual tenancies. And say you could have let a room for £450 a month. All of a sudden, that's £2,250 on a monthly basis, which instead of £1,300 is a huge amount of difference.
A huge difference. I mean, what would you say the risks involved are?
So with things like HMOs, things like that, typically the risks are you will likely require a license to operate a HMO in the vast majority of areas now. You would have additional safeguards that you need to adhere to on that type of property and that type of rental. Also, you might find that you are likely to cover the bills, because if you've got five different people, it's very different to allocate who's liable for what. So as the landlord, you might say that we all cover all the gas, electric and water, but then you incorporate that into the rent that you're charging for the individual room so that it's spread against all five, for example. The biggest risk, however, on this type of scheme is really the higher turnover of tenant types, as we mentioned on the previous example with the multi-unit freehold, where it might be to a couple. If you're renting a room to somebody, it's generally for somebody that might be a young professional just getting out of the house for the first time, just started their new job, has maybe have changed areas, don't know the area, and just want to keep a relatively low cost monthly payment just to move in somewhere so they can be closer to where they're going to work or closer to friends or family or wherever it may be and have their own space. So they're just starting out. And once they are in the position to say, right, this is where I'm going to be, they'll then look for maybe a one bed flat to move into so they have their full space. So the turnover for that is quite high. Again, it might even be students. So they're in the area, mature students only really need to be there for 8 or 9 months. And once that's done and their course is finished, right, back they go. So the turnover and the likelihood of that tenant being there for multiple years is a lot lower. So again, there's always that constant churn. And again, there'll be fees involved. And then if one of the properties isn't rented out for a month, then obviously that's a month lost. So again, it's a higher risk, but potentially for a much higher return when everything is fully let.
Nathan, I think that's all we've got time for today. We've spoke for absolutely ages, but I can't thank you enough for your time and the information you've shared with us. It's been really informative.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on, and hopefully it's been of interest to your listeners.
Absolutely. So I just want to say thank you for listening. We hope you've all enjoyed today's show. If you have, please kindly like and subscribe. Bye for now.
You have been listening to RBP's Accountancy on Prescription podcast. For any updates, please visit www.rbp.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at RBPCA. The contents of this podcast is for general guidance and informational purposes only and does not constitute any form of advice. The information provided by RBP is of a general nature. Appropriate and tailored advice or independent research should be obtained before making any decisions. RBP does not accept any liability for any loss or damage which is incurred from you acting or not acting as a result of listening to Accountancy on Prescription.